Collier, the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. You may be seated. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case set for oral argument. I understand all the counsel have checked in. So before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have here today. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. And I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Randall McDaniel, may it please the court. Edward Gayton will argue for the appellant in the cross appellate versus Harlan Monroe, Bindi, and Core Mark Midcotton, Inc. And Scott Cummings will argue for the appellate in the cross appellate.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May I please the court?
Yes. And I understand that microphone is not working, so I'll just remind everybody to speak up so we can hear you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. As just mentioned, my name is Eddie Gaithan. I am the attorney that represented the plaintiff at the trial of this case, as well as the attorney representing through the appellate process here. We are plaintiff appellate and cross appellee. Client's name is Randall McDaniel, and this case stems from a commercial motor vehicle accident that occurred back in October 9th of 2015. And I'm certain the court is prepared and has read the briefs and know, so please stop me if I'm getting too much into facts about just background. But as far as facts go, it's undisputed that the commercial motor vehicle accident occurred on October 9th, 2015. Defendant at the trial, appellee, cross appellant here, Farland Dindy, as well as his employer, Coremark. Dindy was a commercial driver in the course and scope of his employment at the time. That's undisputed for Coremark. He was driving a commercial motor vehicle, an 18-wheeler, with the tractor truck pulling a trailer, and as well, he was pulling a dolly that typically would attach a second trailer if he was pulling doubles. And the record will show that Mr. Dindy was a driver based out of Oklahoma, a shuttle driver based out of Oklahoma, and he would have a PM shift, work through the night, drive from Oklahoma, drop off things in Fort Worth or exchange trucks, trailers, and then after that he would head back to Oklahoma, all in, you know, just the overnight shift. this collision took place on I-35, and what happened was the dolly came free on the highway, and the record shows that Mr. Dindy was traveling at highway speeds.
There's really not any dispute, is there, that it wasn't attached properly?
Correct.
So we can, yeah.
Okay.
We're familiar with.
And that's correct, Justice. There's no dispute that it wasn't connected properly. Coremark's own representative testified of the same from beginning of you know, from voir dire through closing. Coremark representatives, as well as the attorneys, indicated that, you know, there was no negligence issue. They took fault. They accepted responsibility. And
did they actually argue that when it came to the actual questions with regard to negligence? In other words, why was negligence submitted if, in fact, it wasn't admit if it had been conceded throughout the trial?
My understanding is that we wanted the negligence to be in the charge, so we have both defendants in there, so it
plus
separates.
Plus set up the gross negligence.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That being said, during closing argument, what was defendant's argument when they got to that point? Did they even discuss the individual question with regard to negligence, either for the driver or for the corporation?
I don't want to misrepresent the record, but I believe my recollection of that argument was that, again, they accepted responsibility. They were here to in trial to take responsibility for the action,
Yeah, I think there was some statement to the effect that we're not here about liability.
Yes, Judge.
So talk to us, though, about the gross negligence evidence against Cormark.
Okay. So the gross evidence or gross negligence evidence that we have with regard to Cormark itself is they have systems in place that are that allow them to monitor their drivers. Cormark, the record will show that they have, at least at that point in time, approximately 3,000 drivers, and they have a PeopleNet system, and that is essentially their electronic log within the trucks. And testimony at trial was that anything you do has to be logged. If you turn on the truck, it's going to be, you know, truck log, turn on. You move, log. The policies as well as the federal regulations show that they're required to do a pre-trip inspection, and that was discussed throughout the trial.
But that's really Mr. Dendy's negligence, though, right?
Correct, Justice.
If I understand from your briefing, the essence of your argument about Cormark's negligence is that someone should have been reading and identifying what was being reported on the PeopleNet system, and either they weren't doing it or they were doing it and not paying attention to it, right?
That's precisely the argument.
And that this transportation team who is supposed to be monitoring it wasn't doing their job, right?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me anywhere in the record where I can find out who that transportation team is and what their duties and responsibilities are that would either make them a vice principal or not make them a vice principal?
The corporate representative, Matt Beard, testified that there was a supervisor of the within the transportation department that was charged with overseeing those records and making corrections as you know, as they came up or as necessary with any deficiencies that they did find.
Can you cite me to the record on that? I remember the portion of his testimony, which was that preferably one person would do it, although there might be more than one person.
Yeah, that's correct. He does say that we typically have one person. He failed to remember the name of that person. And then he said, but depending on the size of the division, it could be multiple people. And
but did he ever describe who they were or what their corporate duties were?
He did describe that the duty was solely to monitor those logs, and that was something that should be done daily. You know, obviously I know there's some argument that it would be impossible to do it live, but that's not our argument. It's the daily aspect of it. There's 7 days of logs with plenty of deficiencies that they had plenty of time to actually review those logs, and the only evidence produced for the trial was 7 days prior of those log sheets, and we found a number of deficiencies, and we believe that a jury could have inferred, obviously, that if there was 2 months prior, that would have been caught and should have been caught and reviewed, remedied.
Was there any testimony? I mean, I understand that Cormark has the ability to monitor these logs on whatever basis they decide is prudent to do. Was there any testimony at trial that connected the ability to review those logs to a federal regulation requiring an employer to review logs?
The testimony from the corporate representative was that they were being reviewed. The purpose of the review was to remain in compliance with DOT as well as federal regulations.
Was there a specific regulation cited?
There was the regulation for the actual pre-trip inspection, one, the process, and two, that it's required.
But I mean, as far as what Cormark's obligation under the federal regulations was as the employer to review the pre-trip inspection logs, was there any reference to a specific regulation that tags an employer with that obligation?
Your Honor, I do believe there was.
On page 18 of your reply brief, you talk about testimony from Mr. Beard, Cormark's corporate representative, that the entire purpose of PeopleNet, that it was the company's, quote, "electronic logging device for DOT compliance," end quote. My understanding from the question is, other than that general statement about what the purpose of PeopleNet was for, which was in fact for Department of Transportation compliance, was there any other testimony that would have been specific that would have described what was meant by DOT compliance? Or was it just a general, we're just supposed to generally infer that PeopleNet was used for DOT compliance, that that would include any federal regulation that was promulgated by the DOT that applied to the trucking company in question?
There was testimony with regard to the, let's see, it was 396 of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration Regulation, 396.11 to be exact. And that regulation mandates that coupling devices must be inspected by the driver on every pre-trip. Mr. Beard does not disagree with that statement. And then,
so this was a system that was put in place as a means of complying with federal regulations for the trucking company?
Yes, Judge. That was the testimony.
And was there testimony that this was the means by which Cormark actually kept track of whether or not it was meeting federal regulations?
The testimony was that it was used to remain in compliance, so it was used to monitor that they were doing that for DOT and federal regulation compliance reasons.
Was there any testimony concerning whether or not the implementation of PeopleNet was a decision by, for example, a janitor associated with Cormark, or would it have been somebody up in the corporate structure that had authority to implement PeopleNet? Was there any discussion about who implemented PeopleNet?
There was, my recollection of the record is that there was no discussion specifically about who implemented it. The only discussion was that there was a team and the supervisor that was charged with reviewing it, and then, you know, remedying such things. And then the driver's testimony regarding the only time anyone ever talked to him about deficiencies within his log was with regard to taking lunch breaks or not taking lunch breaks. So there is some evidence that they were being monitored, just not follow through within their own policies as far as actually fixing or remedying those issues and the deficiencies.
Okay, I think what my colleague is asking you about with regard to who is the testimony that you've got at pages 18 and 19 that you reference in that portion of your reply brief. I'm assuming it's from Beard. Talks about a leadership team. It talks about a supervisor. It talks about a transportation team. And when asked specifically about what would be the result of the finding of a violation in PeopleNet, whoever this witness is says, he's asked specifically, you know, who does this go to? Is it a dispatcher or somebody in the safety department? He answers, yeah. Incredible clarity there. It would be logged on their web, on the website through PeopleNet at that time. And then later on page 20, if a driver had left the yard, picked up trailers, and didn't do a report, that's something that somebody in the company who's receiving these reports should note immediately and ask him about or reprimand him for. It would be, and then the answer was, it would be reviewed and counseled accordingly. Is that the only thing we have in the record with regard to the authority of the individual responsible for looking at PeopleNet as to taking disciplinary action against a driver who is not in compliance?
I believe the reference to the leadership team, the quotes that you've just read, I believe that might have been the only testimony presented at trial.
Okay.
counsel, in the court's JNOV order, the judge found that the plaintiff has not alleged or proven that Core-Mark is vicariously liable for Dindy's gross negligence under the exceptional liability standard, citing Hamerly Oaks, Inc. versus Edwards. Hamerly Oaks specifically talks about the various means by which a corporation can be held to be vicariously liable for the acts of an employee. And it talks about corporate vice principals, it talks about corporate direct authorization, and it talks about ratification. Where did you, first off, oppose this or challenge this in your brief in the case as the appellate?
Counselor, your time's up, but I'll give you a little time to briefly respond to the court's question.
Thank you, Justice. The reply portion to that extent of it was the point we were trying to make was with the leadership team, the transportation department, the people overseeing, to show that there's people in a managerial capacity acting in that scope of employment that do have supervising powers. They can remedy, they can counsel. Those are the types of that's what the exceptional liability the law or the rule resorts to, with, you know, whether it's a principal authorized doing things, or if they're just ratifying because they're looking the other way, so they're authorizing it. That's again just through that leadership supervision and nothing happening. Nothing that was done to Mr. Dindy, no talks, no punishment, until after this happened and they terminated him.
Thank you.
Counsel, may it please the court. The trial court's JNOV order in this case is straightforward. The case law when it comes to gross negligence from the Texas Supreme Court and from this Court of Appeals is consistent in what it requires, the evidentiary burden that has to be met by any party that wants to get to gross negligence. The Supreme Court back in 2012 in Waldrop laid out that a party cannot be liable for gross negligence when it actually and subjectively believes that the circumstances pose no risk to the injured party, even if they are wrong.
But wouldn't that position give Core-Mark an incentive to not? I mean, if all they're theoretically on the hook for is just negligence, if their drivers are not hooking things up properly, then does that not give Core-Mark much of an incentive to review these pre-trip inspections to make sure that things are being done correctly, even if on a random spot basis?
I think that the problem with that, Your Honor, is that there was absolutely no testimony down at the trial level of what the standard was for Core-Mark to review those. Is it normal in the industry to do it daily? Is it normal to do it weekly? Is it normal to do it monthly or quarterly? If there had been some testimony of what the standard in the industry was, then I think Your Honor's argument would make a whole lot of sense. But for all we know, the standard in the industry is to look at these monthly and then go back, or perhaps to look at it quarterly. Maybe it's even annually. That's why when it comes to gross negligence, the burden is on the party seeking gross negligence to bring forward that evidence. And that's really what I believe Judge Fahey was focusing on in her JNOV order, when she starts with the language that there was no evidence or testimony regarding the federal requirements or industry standards by which employers should monitor their drivers' pre-inspection reports or catch those red flags. If there had been such testimony, and if there was an industry standard that was established, then I think you're right. That would address the sort of, I think it's a perverse incentive argument that you're looking at, Justice Kerr, and I get that. But that's the burden that goes on the party seeking to get gross negligence. It's why we hold.
Federal regulations were in evidence, correct?
There were some federal regulations in evidence, okay. But not the ones.
Was there any federal regulation in evidence with regard to inspection frequency?
There was not, and that's why Judge Fahey in her order specifically addresses that.
So there's federal regulations saying that these inspections need to take place.
There were.
But there's nothing with regard to federal regulations with regard to their frequency.
It is, and again, without the entire record in front of me, I don't want to misstate. It's my recollection it was not. I believe that is what Judge Fahey in her order says. And certainly if there was, I think that would have been highlighted in the briefing by the appellant. In this case, the real issue that we have, it's sort of threefold when we get to the gross negligence issue. They've got to show objective and subjective, but they've also got to establish some industry standard of care when it comes to looking at these pre-trip inspections. I think your honors are correct. They can't get there on the vice principal. I understand the questions, but there's just not the evidence in the record that would support that. Kevin, they don't even address it.
Did you object to the omission of a vice principal element with regard to gross negligence against Core-Mark?
We objected to all of the charge.
No.
When
did you object to the failure of the court to submit vice principal as an element with regard to the gross negligence submission against Core-Mark?
I'd have to go back and look at the record.
My recollection of the actual gross negligence is the objective and subjective standards are with regard to Core-Mark. Okay, so there's no mention of any vice principal there at all, one way or the other. So why should we not take that as, and the failure to object to it, that if there's any evidence to support the existence of a vice principal relationship, i.e. a managerial capacity with regard to the transportation team, that would be sufficient to supply the vice principal situation? Because you don't actually argue that there's no vice principal here.
Respectfully, Your Honor, in both of our briefing below, our argument was they haven't even asserted that, and the judge in her order said that, and then that wasn't briefed here at the Court of Appeals. But we did object to the gross negligence question. We moved for directed verdict on it. We then moved for JNOB
on
it.
Okay, counsel, I can object to a gross negligence question. How did you object to the gross negligence question? Did you object that it didn't submit a vice principal, which is required for gross negligence on a vicarious basis under the law of Texas?
Our objection was there was legally insufficient evidence to reach that.
Okay, that's not the same thing.
I understand, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
This court also, in Cowboys Concert Hall, and in another case that I came across yesterday as I was preparing, the Witt versus North American Michelin has taken a look at gross negligence and consistently has held that there are standards that have to be met. And with respect to the evidence that's before this court, you simply cannot get there on gross negligence, and that's why Judge Fahey properly granted the JNOV. In fact, the evidence below established that there was no standard of care testimony elicited stating that a failure to audit pre-trip inspections in real time is gross negligence, or certainly even that it's negligence. In fact, the testimony from the corporate representative was that Core-Mark, no witness knew that the pre-trip inspection had not been performed or that the dolly hadn't been properly attached. Everyone at Core-Mark who testified said they would never have let the truck leave the lot if they were aware the dolly had not been attached properly. Mr. Dindy testified that he believed he had attached the dolly properly. Now, he might be wrong, and that's why we have negligence as compared to gross negligence, and we'll come to that in a little while when we deal with our cross points with respect to the gross negligence of Mr. Dindy. But the bottom line is, the consistent testimony from everyone was neither the driver nor the employer believed the dolly had not been properly attached when it left the lot. If they had, they never would have left the lot.
Counsel, is there a distinction to be made with regard to the Fulgham decision upon which you rely with regard to nonfeasance versus misfeasance? Okay. In other words, you're arguing that for any gross negligence or even negligence to be found here, there has to be expert testimony of what the standard would have been with regard to the attachment of this particular piece of equipment. Am I correct in that?
Yes, Your Honor. This isn't a res ipsa case.
Okay. And you're relying predominantly on the Fulgham case with regard to the refrigerator trailer and the rotted bolts, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay. But we have testimony in this record that if, in fact, the safety chains or the, I forget the other thing that would have been attached, had in fact been attached, they would have been damaged when this thing cut loose. And there was no damage to the chains, and there was no damage to the other attachments with regard to that. Why is that not evidence, some evidence, that the thing was not done as opposed to the thing was done improperly? Whereas the thing not being done is something that laypeople can figure out, the thing being not done properly is something that requires expert testimony.
And that goes to the testimony of Mr. Terry. And Mr. Terry came upon the scene after the accident. He obviously wasn't there, did not see it before it occurred. And so his views or what he sees is obviously going to be colored by you've got something that's come loose and is now off on its own. But he was asked about policies at Core-Mark with respect to how do you attach these things. The problem here, and it's the connection, the plaintiffs, for whatever reason they chose, did not put on any expert to talk about how this dolly should have been attached, what should have been done, and what makes it a proper attachment. They instead did, as the plaintiffs in the FFE Fulgham case did, they relied on the company witnesses. And that court and another federal court have said that doesn't get you there because that tells you what the company standard is, but that's not necessarily the industry standard of care, and it's the industry standard of care that you have to show.
So you're telling me that lay people can't figure out that a 3,000-pound piece of equipment, whether it should be or should not be attached to a truck?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about, nonfeasance.
Yeah.
Okay? You're talking about misfeasance, which is, did he do it correctly?
Yeah.
I agree with you with regard to Fulgham in that regard. My question is does Fulgham extend into nonfeasance?
The problem you have, though, Your Honor, is this isn't a Ray Zipsa case because it could have come loose because of a product defect. It could have come loose for any of a number of other hypothetical reasons. And by not putting on expert testimony that this wasn't properly attached and it came loose because it wasn't properly attached.
Are your two employees who testified that it wasn't attached, are they not satisfactory evidence of the fact that it wasn't done the way it should have been done?
The problem, and I get where Your Honor's coming from, and frankly, I had intended to focus more on the future medicals with respect to our two cross points, because I understand the case law, though, is out there that says if it's company policy, that's not the industry standard of care. And so what they did, similar to what, I apologize, Your Honor, go ahead, sir.
But counsel actually read into evidence the federal regulations and then asked your company employees if that's the way it was supposed to be done, yeah, and that it wasn't done. So is evidence of failure to comply with federal regulations not evidence of negligence?
And what he was talking about was putting the chains on. Is that
right,
what Your Honor is referencing,
right,
to? Yeah. The issue, again, is there was no testimony that...
But is evidence of violation of federal safety regulations, is that not violation of industry standards since they're required to comply with the federal regulations?
I see where Your Honor is going. I think what I would rely on is that because there was no statement that this is the industry standard of care, they don't get there, but I understand where Your Honor's coming from. With respect to, and I want to jump back real quick to gross negligence to make sure that I put this in. This is the only time a converter dolly's ever come loose for Core-Mark. That was undisputed. It's the only time a converter dolly's ever come loose for Mr. Dindy. When we're talking about the gross negligence in particular, there simply wasn't the evidence there, whether it was the testimony of showing, and here's the critical part. It's not just you've got to show the objective and the subjective. You've also got to show they acted that way because they knew and they just didn't care. That's simply not present in the record here.
Well, if the evidence shows that the chains weren't actually on, and there's a reasonable inference that the chains weren't actually on because they weren't damaged when this thing came off the truck, why is it not a reasonable inference that either one, he knew they weren't on and he didn't care, or two, he didn't inspect to make sure they were on and he didn't care? And again, that's nonfeasance as opposed to whether they were attached properly or not. And why is that not a basis for the jury to reach the decision they did with regard to the driver?
Well, with regard, so let's talk about Mr. Dindy, and that really is the subjective part. And what I want to focus on is three things with Mr. Dindy. Number one, Mr. Dindy consistently said he believed he had done it properly. Now, he may have been wrong, and certainly that's why we have negligence.
Jury didn't believe him, correct?
Yeah, it's clear the jury didn't believe him, but he consistently said that. He consistently said he would not have driven off the lot if he hadn't. But that's why gross negligence has the different standard. It's got that subjective. You've got to show. And Mr. Dindy had the doubles endorsement. He had the training. He'd never before had a dolly come loose, right? This isn't a guy who clearly, and he'd been a driver, I forget, was it 30-something years that he'd been a driver and had never had a dolly come loose. So you simply don't have the subjective element when it comes to Mr. Dindy of
he signed a statement after the fact saying, I believe that I did it property, right?
Yes, and he testified to that as well.
Isn't there a line of cases that says that if you continue to deny that you did something when, in fact, it's clear that you did, that that is some evidence of gross negligence that will support a jury's verdict?
There is certainly case law to that effect. The issue here, of course, is he's saying he thought he did it, and he stayed consistent with it. So from his perspective, at least on the subjective component, he has consistently said he believed he did it, and that's why. The last thing I want to spend, because I'm coming towards the end of my time, is on the future medical damages. And the reason that I want to focus on that is this is a very interesting case. Unlike cases like Antonov that this court has had in the past, the plaintiffs chose not to put in any evidence of past medical damages. They also chose to put two medical experts on the stand, and from neither medical expert did they elicit testimony as to anticipated future medical costs and what the reasonableness of those costs might be. They floated all the way around on a number of things, on future rhizotomies, on how often nerves regenerate or don't regenerate. But never once did they, from either of their two medical experts, establish a life expectancy for the plaintiff, a number of future surgeries, or even an estimated number, and a reasonable and necessary cost. Nor, and this was a decision the plaintiffs made, did they put in any evidence of past medical costs. The jury then awarded $95,000 in future medicals based on what can only be described as speculation. And we cited in our briefing the testimony from Dr. Gardner, who was one of the physicians that the plaintiffs put on at the time of trial. He hadn't seen Mr. McDaniel since March of 2020. He testified that he thought continued ablations would help, but he admitted he didn't perform them, and he didn't know the cost of them. And while he testified that Mr. McDaniel will be in pain management, he testified at the time of trial McDaniel had not scheduled any current appointments with him. So it had been over a year, and he gave no number, no cost. The other physician was Dr. Eames. McDaniel had last seen Dr. Eames when he had a rhizotomy in July of 2020. He'd been released in August 2020, and as of trial, hadn't consulted with Dr. Eames again. And
Dr. Eames testified, though, did he not, that the nerves can regenerate, and that can regenerate in 6 to 12 months, and that's something which can be seen with respect to this type of injury?
Yes, Your Honor. His exact testimony was it can be as soon as 6 months, or it can last a couple of years. It just depends. And that's at 7 RR98. He also testified Mr. McDaniel, and these are his words, could potentially need another rhizotomy in the future. He would expect it typically, his words, a year or two apart, and that's at 7 RR99. The problem, of course, with all of that is we have no life tables put in by the plaintiffs. We have no reasonable and necessary costs. We have no statement of how many surgeries or even an estimate. And when you look at the case law that's out there, Powell, Pearson, Tijerina, and I believe even this own court's opinion in Antonov, where you upheld an award of future medical, but you talked about how the doctor talked about reasonable and necessary costs. None of that testimony is present here. This $95,000 number is plucked out of the air. It is the ultimate speculation that the case law simply doesn't support a plaintiff reaching. And I really want to emphasize this. It's from the Powell case. When mere speculation and conjunction are given, that's legally insufficient evidence. In Powell, because there was no evidence to support a fixed amount, the court reduced the award to zero. In Pearson, they talked about a range of expenses being too speculative and reduced the award to zero. And I think much like the outcomes in those cases, the Tijerina case that we also cite, that McDaniel's claim for future medical costs was too speculative. We believe Judge Fahey could have properly granted and should have properly granted a JNOV on that, and we believe that this court ought to overturn that award find that there was insufficient evidence for it. The last thing I'm going to deal with, and we've kind of already dealt with it, but that's Mr. Dindy's gross negligence, and I think the court has the briefing in front of it. The subjective element of gross negligence has to mean something, right? If a person is consistent in their testimony, and if, as here, you have the evidence of an over 30-year driving history, a doubles endorsement, the appropriate training, never having had a dolly come loose, this is a negligence case. It's simply not gross negligence. And I'll, if there are no other questions, I'll certainly give back the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel, if we could pick up where we just left off, where in the record is there any evidence of the amount of medical expenses, either past or future?
Counsel is correct in stating that we did not present evidence of past medical bills. However, we did. I think he might have just misspoken, but he said we didn't present any past medical records, which we did, just no billing. We didn't ask for damages for past medical. There was actually testimony from the plaintiff stating that he paid a certain amount of money out of pocket for his previous rhizotomy, and I believe the record actually would show that it was approximately 8 months that he had received that rhizotomy prior to trial, not a full year.
So was there any testimony that the amount that was paid was reasonable?
I don't believe the plaintiff testified to reasonableness other than just the fact that that's what was paid.
Did any of the doctors testify that that sum was reasonable?
Without the record in front of me, I can't say specifically if they did or did not.
So do you agree that the question of whether amounts paid for medical expenses are reasonable is a matter of expert opinion?
I believe that's definitely the law for past medical. In terms of future medical, the door's open a little bit more.
As to whether it has to be reasonable?
Well, it's a reasonable probability is followed for...
But do the amounts have to be reasonable, not just the... whether or not it's necessary, but do the amounts have to be reasonable for future medical expenses?
In the case that we've cited in the brief on page 30, or my reply on page 30, got in here, a plaintiff must show that there is a reasonable probability that such expenses will be incurred in the future. So just the reasonable probability refers to them being necessary into the future, not the case, because by its very nature, and the case goes on to say that nature of plaintiff's injuries, condition of plaintiff at the trial, at the time of the trial, it solely relies, or mostly within the jury's discretion, because issues such as life expectancy, medical advances, and the future cost of productive services are by their very nature uncertain. Appellate courts are particularly reluctant to disturb a jury's award with these damages. So on top of that, the defense actually at trial presented evidence of a pharmacy bill or billing records, and that itself showed a history from 2015 or so all the way to the time of trial in 2020 of consistent pharmacy prescriptions being refilled, pain medication, things like that. All of the evidence in the records, medical records, as well as the testimony from the doctors show that this is a chronic condition. He's in pain chronically. There was testimony, again, it was just referenced that rhizotomies could be, he reasonably could need it every 6 to 2 years. And the different doctors said between 6 months and, 1 year or 2 years.
Was there evidence of the reasonableness of the pharmacy bills, or was it just bills?
They were put on by the defense. We did not object to any of the reasonableness within them.
No. My question is, for example, were there affidavits attached establishing the reasonableness of the expenses, or did they just offer bills themselves?
Oh, they were attached with affidavit.
I'm going to ask the clerk to add one more minute because we had a glitch in the matrix on the on the timer. So I think that you got cheated a little bit. So you've got 55 seconds.
Choose
if you
the red
want
pill
to.
Or the blue pill.
Okay, and thank you, Your Honor. Going back to some of the statements that were made earlier. There was no defects. The Core-Mark officials, representatives testified that there was absolutely no defect, so that's not an issue with the equipment. To say that, you know, we don't know what happened or how the trailer came off, that's just not within the record. Everyone is clear that there's no defect. The trailer just wasn't put on properly. I mean, that's what it comes down to, and that's why expert testimony is not necessary in that situation for all the reasons that have already been discussed. But, you know, that FFE case specifically, that is not about it's distinguishable because that involves needing an expert to determine the strength and, you know, resiliency of a rusty bolt. That was the issue in that case, which obviously would require expert testimony in a case like this.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time's up. All right, gentlemen, we appreciate the argument. It's been very helpful. And your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your day. We'll be in recess. Thank you.